This episode is brought to you by NordVPN. Listen up, nerds. No. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border and coast to coast and all the ships at sea.
What?
Hello, friends. Do you have a computer? Of course you do, because it's not 1987. Hell, you're listening to this on some kind of computer right now. But do you have a VPN? Oh, what's a VPN, you ask? Well, my friend, a VPN is a virtual private network and it offers two key benefits: enhanced privacy and security online. But VPNs do a lot more than that. VPNs shield your IP address, change your browsing location, and make online life easier. It's all about safety and security, my friends. But like everything else in life, it's also about watching TV. Don't let your paid subscriptions go to waste. I use NordVPN to access my home content while I'm traveling. Wink, wink. Plus, secure your connection on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere you go when you're traveling. There's over 6,300 servers in 111 countries, and you can find a nearby server for the best VPN speeds. NordVPN is easy to use. Connect with one click or enable auto-connect for zero-click protection. And it's got amazing speed. NordVPN is one of the fastest VPNs out there. And with just one NordVPN account, you can use it on 6 devices. It supports every major platform: Windows, Android, iOS, macOS, Linux, even Android TV. I think those are all real. Don't miss out on all the awesome benefits for using a VPN. Go to nordvpn.com/ifanboy today for a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee. The link's in the show notes. Once again, that's nordvpn.com/ifanboy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found — I am not a therapist — I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it, and sometimes it makes you realize, like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it. Work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/ifanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, HELP.com/ifanboy.
What up? You're listening to the iFanboy Pick of the Week podcast, episode 228, brought to you by InStock Trades and Summit City Comic Con. Hey, welcome to the iFanboy.com Pick of the Week podcast, episode 228. My name is Paul Montgomery, and I'm here with Jim Rochkowski.
Wow, is that how you say that?
Isn't it?
It is, as a matter of fact. Hi, guys.
Very, very good.
Okay, and the troublemaker over there, Mike Romo.
Hey, guys. Hi, guys. How are you?
Screw you,
it's
man.
The writer's show. We're back.
Yes.
Did you miss us?
April Fools.
This is the first time I've been on. This is the first time I've been on since August. I would imagine a good half the people listening don't even know who I am.
You're Jim Rochkowski. So I got it again.
Right.
Anyways, at ifanboy.com, we like comics and we read comics. And every week we read a bunch of comics. And then not one of us, but usually Josh, Ron, or Connor picks the best one and then writes about it on the website. Then we all talk about it on the podcast, or they talk about it on the podcast. I got to fix this script. Along with various other topics of interest. But before we get to the show, a quick reminder / warning. This is a review show, and we will be talking about the things that happen in this week's books. So if you're worried about spoilers, deal with it.
You've made a huge mistake.
Yeah.
You've done things out of order. So this week, Josh had the pick, and luckily Scalp didn't come out.
Yeah, exactly.
And he picked Blackest Night number 8, finale, the grand finale.
The big book, and it just doesn't seem right somehow that Josh is in here.
Right, we'll take the duct tape off of Josh's mouth, and he can come and talk about it. Hey, Josh.
Hey.
So what do you like about this book?
Yeah. Why'd you pick it? Just talk it out quick. Yeah, hurry up.
People out there just had little mini heart attacks. Well, I want to hear him talk about it.
Four adjectives. Let's go.
Well, historically, whenever there's been like a book that I was supposed to talk about, I don't get to. It's always my pick. I have a baby. I go get my appendix pulled. There was another thing. You guys did this last time.
Right. Yeah. Flash Rebirth number one was your pick.
Miniseries, is it over?
No. Is it?
It is. The last one just came out.
It's been over for me for about 6 months.
It was a photo finish.
Blackest Night number 8. It was not a week of extreme challenges to this.
No.
It was not.
And I think when I started to think about what it was not my first choice, like I didn't finish and be like, that's it, I'm done. I had to think about it, but when I sort of laid them all out and I thought about what it was going to be, it seemed to be the book that sort of stood above the others in the sense of the larger accomplishment of the whole thing.
Totally.
I don't feel like a lot of people felt this way, but I certainly felt like in the middle of it, I was like, okay, let's get on with it. Let's finish up.
Are you talking about the middle of the issues or the middle of the series?
The middle of the mini series.
Oh, amen.
Where I was like, okay, I don't know if this is 8 issues worth of story, but I get what he's like. One of the things that Geoff Johns does really well is juggle. He juggles like his life depends on it. I mean, the man, if he was a magician, he would hold the world records for like he could do 5 chainsaws, 6 chickens, 2 bowling balls, you know, right. Like do that. And so when I sort of was reading through this, I was like, wow, he actually managed to pull all that stuff together, because at the end of the last one, I was like, this is just a mess.
Yeah.
I don't really know who the bad guy is. I don't know. It's all these things that have to be accomplished. And to be completely fair to him, he accomplished all of them.
Yeah.
Not to everybody's specific satisfaction, I don't believe, but to mine. And I felt like, I was like, okay, you know, it was a satisfying ending. And in a very sort of classic comic book way, you know, he left some things to be dealt with. And more than that, I felt like he cleaned up a lot of things that needed cleaning. As a lot of people know, he's now the DC Chief Creative Officer, a title which I don't think I've ever heard in terms of a comic book company, but there you go.
I looked it up when they first announced that, and I think that's a title that you usually only see at video game companies.
Yeah. Advertising you see in places like that. But so he's kind of in charge of what goes on creatively. As the title would imply anyway. And so he set up this sort of status quo where he's like, all right, I'm bringing back all of these dead characters.
These specific dead characters.
Right, apparently. But not others. And then he sort of set up a thing. He said, okay, from now on, dead is dead. So basically, right. I got to do it. Now no one else ever gets to until he's not there anymore. He brought back, he loves Hawkman and Hawkgirl. That's been very clear for a while. He brought back that kid from 52, the little Black Adam.
Osiris.
Yeah, he likes Firestorm a lot, so he brought him back. Brought Jade back for some reason. Hawk of Hawk and Dove, who I don't have any experience with, really. Martian Manhunter, who needs to be alive. And Aquaman, who I think was also missed. So those are sort of two, and then a couple other. Oh, yeah, Captain Boomerang. I wonder why you did that. He brought them back. Oh, and Boston Brand, Dead Man.
Yeah. Has he ever been alive, Dead Man?
Not that I know of.
He was
not
born alive, and then he became.
Right, but in the stories.
So it would be a foolish name.
It would be a foolish. Now he's a live man.
Yeah.
So did this actually all take place over one night? I mean, it has been a very long
time. That was part of my ranting, and I come at this as somebody who really only knows the DC universe through Geoff Johns' Green Lantern run and some miscellaneous Gotham City stuff. And Josh was talking about needing the kind of being ready for this to end in the middle of the miniseries. And I definitely went into number 8 with a chip on my shoulder, because for all the griping I heard about the Savage Land a year and a half ago, Jesus Christ, they were setting up tents in the Savage Land and roasting marshmallows by about issue 6 of this. And I just, But I gave it the benefit of the doubt because I don't know. Maybe if you know who all the people in that two-page splash who are flying around shooting beams at one another are, this has a huge emotional resonance to you that it maybe doesn't have to me. So
he
did
explain all of it in the subsequent pages.
Yeah. I don't mean to imply that I was left, that I was orphaned or anything by the story.
I think it's the blackest night, and there's no necessary length on that night. Everything went black, and they took care of it. It took as many hours as it did. I don't know. It wasn't something
it's
I really.
Like, it's like Alaska. It's dark for a longer period of time.
It's an enormous.
I think so that. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying. Speaking of juggling, I mean, give it up for Mr. Ivan Rice. I mean, there are a couple spreads here that I mean, my eyes have been fatigued from the storyline. I will admit there have been lots and lots of people on these pages, but I think he finished really strong. I could see an artist. I mean, I can't believe his hand hasn't fallen off. Frankly.
Well, this is to me the real story. This actually led with this in my pick of the week review. That the story of this is the art team. Ivan Rice, and he only had two inkers on this one, but even so, I couldn't tell. You know, it wasn't to the detriment of it. And also, Alex Sinclair on colors. I can't think of a book where color mattered more, and I think that the color for this was perfectly handled. But even you know, basically, Ivan Rice was the Ethan Van Sciver also ran previously. I don't think that's a surprise to anybody.
Totally.
You know, listen, we can't get Ethan Van Sciver to do the book, or it'll take Ethan Van Sciver 9 years to do the book. So let's get this other guy from Brazil, Ivan Rice. But to me, you know, at this point, you know, he's second to nobody.
Yeah.
He's not Ivan Rice's, or he's not Ethan Van Sciver's backup. He is the guy who delivered every single page of this book, and he did it, I think, more or less on time.
Well, yeah, any delays were built in from the outset. Yeah, nothing lagged, I don't
think. Yeah, and you know, there's not a page of this that I was like, oh, phone that page in. No.
Right.
Every page of this was
it's all two-page splashes with 400 guys on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's spectacular in comparison to Flash Rebirth, if you're going to compare the two artists, but even standing on its own, it's really amazing work.
Oh, and like one of the things that you'll hear when you talk to comic book artists is that a solo book has its own challenge. But a guy who's doing, you know, Spider-Man, he's got to draw Spider-Man constantly, something like this. But this book, much like Civil War was for Steve McNiven, like there's a lot of research that has to be done. You have to learn how to draw every character. And for like Civil War, Steve McNiven got behind because of that. And Ivan Rice didn't. And this is not, I'm not saying it against Steve McNiven. It's just like, this is how it works. Like you know, an artist doesn't go into a book knowing suddenly how to draw every character that DC Comics has ever did. And then to draw them in a brand new design, dead version of themselves.
I was going to say, and draw half of them as rotting corpses.
Right.
With previously unworn Black Lantern tutus on or whatever. And
yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, there's backgrounds in the whole thing and dynamic layouts. And just like, literally, the man, like his right arm, supposing he's right-handed or left, must be, you know, far out of proportion with the rest of his atrophied body. just one really healthy arm and
he
a
looks
sick,
like,
sickly body on the other side.
Yeah, he looks like Popeye or Gauntlet or one of those random characters. I ever since that once upon a time when I was doing my column on iFanboy, I decided to examine the issue of lateness in comics by drawing my own comic, and I found that just with my rudimentary skills, just trying to get two pages done in 1 week, the last page was primarily stick figures on featureless, you know, unending backgrounds. And so when I opened up the four page gatefold with all the now alive again characters, just that alone, my heart went out to the guy for, you know, the service that he has rendered to the DC universe.
It's an endurance challenge. It really is.
Yeah.
Just going through the pages. It's amazing.
You know, but not only that, but the pages are really good. I mean, if you're into this really kind of classic modern superhero kind of comic book page, this isn't Alex Maleev and this isn't, you know, Sean Phillips. This is, you know, descendant of Neil Adams, you know, descendant of Jack Kirby kind of thing. And they're really good, good pages. You know, they're high.
And at the descendant of those artists. But at the same time, I don't think that before this unique moment in history, this story could have been told in this way. If for no other reason than like the color palette didn't support the level of nuance that was necessary, or you know the fact that 20 years ago you would have seen a scene like that and the army of undead rising from the grave would have been sort of depicted as an indistinct blob in the background.
Yeah.
Whereas now everybody, you can see the guy's breakfast on his tie mm-hmm. in the background.
And because of all that, it was a good ending, and endings are hard. It's so hard to, I mean, this is not even just the ending to Blackest Night. This is the third act of the magnum opus that started with Rebirth and then Sinestro. Yeah. And everyone liked it for the most part, you know, and I was like, you know, that was good. You have to give it up in the same way that, you know, just, you know, John's is, there's nothing spectacular going on in these pages. I've said lots of time. He's like a craftsman though.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't blow you away with stuff. He just does the work and he does it really good. And it's impressive. And
what's
so that, that was what I walked away with.
Go ahead, Mike. No.
No, I'm just thinking, like, just in terms of ending, in comics, the end always has to hint at a beginning. And I found myself very, very satisfied after an extremely long run, but also, like, really looking at the possibilities with all these new characters and this new status quo. Like, this is pretty exciting. And even though I know that Brightest Day is coming, it looks mercifully short. You know, it's not like this huge long-term event, but Johns has made something kind of really exciting about what's next in the DC universe.
Yeah, I think the thing that was really difficult about this issue is that everybody knows Brightest Day is next. So that's it wasn't just the expectations of this being the third act of something. This is the appetizer for something else. And you know, it pretty much delivered, and you know, it's not the deepest comic. The concepts are really cool. I'm really excited about all the things that are on the menu for Brightest Day. I love seeing these characters resurrected and saying that, you know, dead is dead from now on. That's a cool mandate to have. Hopefully they stick with it.
I didn't even really come away from the story knowing that that was a fact. That just sounded like the opinion of, I don't remember if it was Barry or Hal.
It felt to me like a guideline. Like he was setting this down.
Editorial mandate.
Yeah, he was just drawing a line in the sand and saying this is it. And but you know, the other thing is, I for so long I expected, you know, Sinestro is going to be the White Lantern, or Hal was going to be the White Lantern, and Sinestro. I pretty much thought that Sinestro was going to kick the bucket in this. I thought he was going to, you know, somehow redeem himself or sacrifice himself, but he's still around. And so there were a lot of surprises in this, like, you know, dead man being alive. That's a really interesting kind of concept. I really like that character, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with him.
I felt like I was a degree removed from all of the, from a lot of the emotional beats, but even I left it giving it a good 3 or 4. Like I kind of went into this having a chip on my shoulder because I had read 7 issues and it didn't look like any resolution had been set up in the previous 7. And so I thought that number after 7, after, you know, 2 or 3 issues of treading water, the Deus Ex Machina was going to come from out of nowhere and wrap the whole thing up with a nice little bow. And I don't think that that happened. I think that, you know, it resolved everything pretty well, and like you said, set up for, you know, the next big thing. But at the same time, I was kind of going, as opposed to going, wow, what an interesting thing they did with Deadman, I kind of went, wow, that I bet if I knew a little bit more about Deadman, that would really blow me away.
But,
like what's Hawk Girl's deal? Obviously,
well,
that is
that. I think that you are overlooking a little bit is that one of the things that the superhero comics do and have always done is that those reveals are twofold.
Or gatefold.
Older readers identify, they go, oh, okay, that's cool. And then new readers, they should spark a sense of curiosity.
Yeah.
And it's one or the other. And I can remember, this goes back to like the box of old comics that I had that were the Avengers. And I didn't know who Gilgamesh was.
Right.
But,
oh, God.
Well, not, okay, maybe he's a bad example. But I didn't know about the Scarlet Witch and the Vision. But like that made me want to learn more about it. So in a way, like, this should, I'm not saying it necessarily will, but should make you curious about one of these characters. Maybe,
yeah.
Like, I'm kind of interested in following up what happens with Deadman. Like, I don't know much about Deadman. I know he shows up every once in a while, and I've always kind of liked him, but, you know, I don't know that much about it. I know about as much as I do the Demon.
I read the Blackest Night Batman miniseries, and he was featured prominently in it, and I kind of went, wow. And they went into his origin a little bit, and I was, you know, in a subtle expositionary way, and I was like, oh, that's an interesting idea for a guy. And so, you know, I have
that's pretty much his deal, you know.
Yeah, that's what he does.
I just, and, I like, you know, his being alive again, I haven't really thought through the implications of what that's going
to be. So now mean. There's going to be a story, and there's going to be stories in all sorts of different books that take place that have to do with Jade and Hawk and Hawkman and Hawk Girl. And I didn't realize that until now. And Firestorm and Iron Man. And yeah. Like, I'm not going to read all those.
No.
But I'm going to pick a couple of them out. I want to know what's going to happen with Aquaman. I do. I don't really care about the Hawk people, but right. I want to know what's going to happen or Firestorm. But I want to know what's going to happen with Deadman.
Yeah, and I've never read Firestorm before, but based on just what I've learned in Blackest Night, seeing what happened in number 8, I was kind of like, oh, that's going to make some problems for all sorts of people.
That's the thing. I have no real affinity for Firestorm, but I know that there's a writer or many writers at DC who have Firestorm stories, and they're just itching to tell those stories. Right. And for all these characters and Aquaman, hopefully, I'm hoping for some good Aquaman stories. And
this book did something I really appreciate. One of my favorite things as a reader, which was it anticipated my nitpicky questions and sort of addressed them. Like when they went so far as to deal with what happens when the Red Lanterns aren't angry anymore. That's something I've been wondering about for many an issue now, ever since the first time I saw that cat vomit up blood. And, you know, it turns out the same
thing happened with this plot-wise is I remember getting to the end, they're attacking Necron, and I thought, what the hell happened to the Black Hand? He was the one the story was about in the beginning. And then he turned it around, and he was like, I'm going to fill in that dot for you. And I was like, well done.
That was a splinter on the chip on my shoulder. What the hell happened to the Black Hand?
My splinter never went away with the whole, like, Superman never really touched on.
Why is Superman in a pawn of Necron suddenly the most impotent, non-existent background player in the whole? Yeah, well.
Thank you.
Because it's not his series, Michael.
There's enough going on, people.
You're right.
All right. You know what? There's too many cats in the fox pen. That's a bad metaphor. Whatever.
Right, tape's going back on.
This show's
I hope you got it all out. Well, thank you for joining us. Did you get it all? Do you feel better?
Mm-hmm. That's what we want to hear. Okay.
It looks good that way.
Yeah.
All right. So, what do we got next, gentlemen? Now that we got the regular host out of there, Detective Comics 863.
Ah, yes.
The conclusion of Jock's arc.
Sort of.
Jock
plus one. Okay. We were talking about this before we started recording, and I'm usually pretty oblivious to art. Like I just don't have an affinity for describing it or kind of noticing the nuances of it like other people do. But as I was reading this, I was like, I don't even know that much about Jock, I hasten to add. But as I read it, I was like, what the hell happened to this guy? And then at one point I thought to myself, you know, if I don't know what the deal is with this art, but if I turned to the last page and saw that Scott Collins had drawn this, I would not be a bit surprised. And then I turned to the last page, and of course that's exactly what it was. And I wanted to run around the sandwich shop and, you know, show it to people, but nobody knew what the hell I was talking about.
Sure. I was really stunned by it, because for me, Detective has always sort of been this wonderful showcase of art, right? And when Jock came on here, I actually felt really let down. I thought it was sort of silly to obviously it was a scheduling thing or whatever, but it was just done so almost flippantly a bit. You know what I mean? It just
going from J.H. Williams or?
No, just going from Jock to Collins in the middle of the issue.
Oh, okay.
We hadn't been prepped for that kind of thing before. I mean, oh, poor me. I got surprised by an artist, but I thought it kind of lost momentum a bit because it was really distracting. It happens right in the middle of the story, and a story that I must admit, guys, I guess I never really got, because I thought they were both going after the guy with the knives in his head. I realize I've been misreading the story the entire time.
It's a little complicated in the way that it's broken down, which sort of has been a thing with Detective Comics, even with J.H. Williams. I mean, as gorgeous as the art has been, it's been a little bit. And as much as I appreciate the like interesting choices to page layouts, it sometimes that gets in a way, and it does get distracting. So this is basically it's a story about this kidnapper, and You're getting a parallel narrative in blue tones and red tones. One's happening in the past, one's happening now. Batman's going after the kidnapper, and Batwoman's going after the kidnapper. And then, it breaks down into a fight, and Scott Collins comes in. So I could see that being doubly jarring with it's two artists, plus it's a complicated setup for how the art is broken down.
I didn't even get any of it. Maybe I was just too tired when I read the other issues. I completely forgot that the blue stuff happened in the past. I'll just have to read it all over again.
Well, I mean, on a visceral level, it hit me where I live. The MO of the cutter, who was the kidnapper, he was basically slicing parts of young girls' faces off so that he could graft them onto his sort of pet hostage's face and her young again. And it disturbed me the previous two issues, but for some reason this issue literally put me off my lunch. Like I have a habit of like buying the comics and then going and sitting and eating them. I read the comics, I eat the lunch. But I do both right thereafter. And I picked out Detective and started reading it, and I was like, I'm gonna have to save this for later. Like I've never even had Walking Dead do that to me. I don't know what's going on.
There's Jock does knives and blades really nicely, I'm finding. You know, his cuts, just his line quality are so visceral.
Yeah.
That I his imagery, even though it's on the surface of it, it's very simple. It's you know, I hate to use the pun, but it's very cutting. And I thought it was a really perfect choice for this story, which is why even though I like Scott Collins a lot, it wasn't like Flash Scott Collins. It was just him.
It's actually a cleaner Scott Collins, which is odd. I don't know if he just, you know, reserves that style for Flash and the Rogues, but or I guess he was trying to be like similar to Jock, to be cleaner like that. But yeah, I could see it working better if it was, you know, that grislier, you know, more sketchy Scott Collins.
So are you guys reading the Question story? I go back and forth with whether I like the art or not. Sometimes I do, and sometimes I just don't get it.
I like the art a lot, except in some of these panels, there's no backgrounds at all.
There's like no backgrounds in most of these panels, man. It's just like crazy.
Yeah, and you're getting a lot of green backgrounds here. And as clean as the art is, I think it works better later on in the night scene with Huntress and the Question, which, by the way, a great team up too. I like seeing those two together. It's a nice pairing, and it's good for the Question to have somebody to riff off of.
I think it's a great pairing. I think for me, I think the art is incongruous to the pairing. I feel like these are really down and dirty Alex Maleev style characters. Obviously, he wouldn't be doing this book, but these guys are real street level characters. And for me, it's almost like this is like the kind of art style you'll see in a video game, like in the cutscenes. It's very animated. It's very cartoony. It seems
it's giving you a Grand Theft Auto vibe.
Yeah, it really is. And for me, like the Huntress and the Question, they're fist fighters. I mean, it opens up with them being tortured. And it's hard for me to take the torture seriously when they look like cartoon characters. So maybe that's just my problem.
I think I think the only other place I've seen these particular characters has been in Gotham Central, so I obviously know what you mean, but
well, so it's
same,
sort of similar
I thought the
to
the same thing about Powers when I started reading it, and I, you know, it's just kind of adapting.
It's sort of similar to Queen of Country if you think about, you know,
oh yeah,
totally
with different art styles, and sometimes
I had the same problem.
Mm-hmm. So
sometimes the incongruity works, like the Founders Three were talking about the Nom recently.
Sure.
And I can remember when I was a kid, the letters column being sort of taken aback by the seriousness of the subject matter contrasted with Michael Golden's sort of cartoony artwork, but the way I felt about it at the time was that if this kind of subject matter was accompanied by a grim and gritty or photorealistic style art, I would be too depressed to keep reading it.
That's interesting.
That's a good point.
So what else we got, guys?
We got Adventure Comics number 9, which, you know what? When I go and see a movie and I see commercials, I feel like they should be paying me to sit in the theater. Like I pay $12 to see a movie and I get all these commercials.
I was thinking about that the other day.
I feel like Adventure Comics should be given away for free, because for me, it's just like, hey, here's the stuff that really should belong in another book, but we're going to just stick it here for 6 pages, but we're still going to charge you $3.99 for it. I'm so irritated by this.
You're suggesting that it's called Adventure Comics because Plug Comics isn't as catchy a name.
Yeah.
Nice.
I was very frustrated by the last issue. I was fuming, and I was like, okay, well, they are obviously not going to do that again, because Last Stand of New Krypton is its own series, and that was just a setup for that.
And now this is just a setup. It's another setup. And like, you can, even on the first page, it's like, read Superman 698 before going any further. Well, I don't really want to do that. I mean, right. I happen to have read it.
It does get a little frustrating, yeah. But
and the stories are so short, and then all of a sudden you're like, go read this other book next week.
Sure.
This, 6 pages later.
When Civil War, gosh, when was it? I guess it was at the end of Civil War. There was a one-shot that came out that sounded very exciting. It like has a story by Warren Ellis, has a story by Brian Bendis, has a story. And like,
yeah.
I bought it and I read it, and it turned out that all of it was 3-page stories teasing the new books that were being
They were like cold opens for you know, episodes or whatever.
The Warren Ellis one for Thunderbolts in particular was just like, yeah, it was like what happens before the credits roll on House or whatever. And then I kind of went, well, what the hell? God damn it. And then what you're telling me is basically now they've turned this into a series. is that correct?
It's an ongoing sampler. Well, I don't know if that's true, but I really enjoyed the first story in here, which is a great sort of genealogy of Brainiac 5, and it goes through mm-hmm. all the Brainiacs. And for anybody who's confused by the Legion, I actually recommend checking this out because it gives a like a really lucid explanation of how all of that works. Not the whole Legion, obviously. That's like 5 omnibi worth of information,
right.
And how would you organize it? But this is a really great piece by James Robinson, and it's sort of like almost an illustrated prose piece because it's all captions, and it's Brainiac 5 sort of talking about what it means to be a Brainiac and how his father Brainiac 4 sort of redeemed the line. It's actually some of the best James Robinson writing I've read in a while.
I agree with you after
all the rise and fall stuff and some of the stuff in JLA, it's really nice, and I think it's a great place to start if you're interested in getting into things like Rebels and the upcoming Legion books. So. And I love all that stuff. I love this cosmic stuff. So even though it does feel sort of like a samplery kind of anthology, I did like these little stories. I thought the middle one was kind of cool. It was, you know, Supergirl and Superboy fighting in outer space, and there's some telepathy going on. It's just fun little stories. So I can understand where you're frustrated, but I had a lot of fun with this, actually.
I think also I had just come off of reading Blackest Night, and this is one of the second or third comic I read after it, and I was just getting really fatigued with big double page spreads of people fighting. And
yeah,
I think
yeah,
I really I can see need that. I need to space it out. And I got to tell you, when I read these sort of sampler books, unfortunately, I still can't even muster up the energy to read the third one.
Story kind of guy.
I just have no interest in it. Like I've already been burned twice with these teasers.
You know what? I think these would all make great single issues if they were expanded out. The third story is actually really kind of interesting. It's an assassination of a Kryptonian who had been in the Phantom Zone, and it's sort of a Black Ops thing. It's a nice little piece by Eric Trautman. I enjoyed that one too. I don't know. They're good little slices of stories. I wish they were longer though.
I've just had a rough week, I guess. I do think that it would be nicer for me if they would just expand these stories and make it a full issue. I'm not a huge fan of splitting the books up. I like the full arc.
You'd rather see the entire James Robinson in one issue, and then the entire Eric Trautman in another, and so on and so on.
Yeah. And then make it a weekly book, huh? There you go. I just solved the problem.
Okay. What's next?
And it should be free, also.
It should be free.
You should win things by reading it.
I understand that both of you guys read A-Team War Stories BA.
With a name like that, how could you not?
Let me tell you something, brother. I know why you did not read this.
I can't. You pity me.
I do.
I pity you for not reading the book. Fool.
You are a fool, and I pity you. Because
stay in school.
I was right there with you a couple of weeks ago, but somebody gave this to me, and I thought, you know, I never would have thought as long as I lived that I would be 30 plus years old reading a G.I. Joe comic. And IDW has shown me that it is not what the thing is about, but how it is about it and who you put in the driver's seat. And what's this I see? I see the name Dixon. Perhaps I'll give this a try. And they did a Hannibal one shot that came out last week or the week before that I just tried out, and it was such a pleasant surprise, such a breath of fresh air, or a breath of flesh air, whatever. I don't care. But I just, if you remember anything, both of these stories so far have taken place during the first Gulf War in, you know, roughly 1991, and focus on each of these characters who I last cared about when I was about 8 years old.
It's what happens to them in the theme song, basically. It's
that's
you
right.
know, what why did they get dishonorably discharged or whatever?
Yeah, and it's just a little vignette, one shot story of, you know, double crosses and hardcore action and fool pitying and occasionally coloring that looks like it was done with sidewalk chalk, but that doesn't detract from the story enough for you to have to worry about it.
A little odd looking, yeah.
Yeah. And did a little bit of that Frank Quitely Batman and Robin stuff where the sound effects are sort of incorporated into the action in a surprising way. But yeah.
I like that.
It's not quite, I don't want you to pick this up expecting Frank Quitely.
That would be an interesting place if he was hiding there, if that's where he
right.
went.
What's he doing in between arcs? Oh, writing Howling Mad Murdoch and his adventures. But yeah, it's one of those things that I never would have guessed in a million years that I would have cared about. I had almost no intention of ever seeing the upcoming A-Team movie that is inspiring all these little spin-offs and tie-ins. But IDW is a small, scrappy company that'll take your license and do something with it that makes you proud you picked them, and this is no exception.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. They should give this out at after school programs to the inner city kids, and you know, don't play with your ball in the street, and
don't trust your lieutenant under any circumstances, kids.
Don't be gun runners.
Right, but yeah, if this is a great candidate for getting in the time machine and rewriting the light week section of iFanboy, because this was a good thing to pick up if you've got a light week.
Yeah,
I like it.
This week, I took a lot of chances. I took a chance on this one, and I'm about to blow some people's minds here. If anybody knows me and what I like, you'll be shocked that this is a book that it might be my pick of the week. This next one coming up, not BA story, but X-Men Second Coming, number one. I gave it a shot.
Here.
When you suggested we talk about this, I just assumed that I was going to be put in some kind of unwelcome spotlight, because I knew that
let's
you
give
had
Jim
read it.
Something to talk about.
No, I was like, there's no way Paul read it. He expects me to tap dance when this comes up. But
I was
no,
like, I'm not you know, typically a Finch fan. I'm not who are the writers. It's Kyle and Yost. Not usually my bag. I'm not a mutant guy. You could consider me part of the Sapien League, but. I was like, I should try something new. We're going to do the show this week. What's the craziest thing I could pick out? And of the two things I picked, this was the good one. So we're going to talk
the
about
other,
that.
The other shall not be mentioned.
The other one shall not be mentioned. But
I got to tell you, man, I have actually dropped all the X-Men books because I just got really tired of it. But,
sure.
So when I saw this, I was like, okay, I'll check it out. And I really liked it. I actually liked the art a lot. I thought he showed some restraint, and I thought the story was good. I was like, oh, good, maybe I'm going to start reading X-Men again all of a sudden. I was really surprised by it.
Yeah, one of the complaints I read on the site about it was that there's not a lot of forward momentum to the X-Men overall story in all their books. Which is good for me.
They're just sort of they're sort of sharing their feelings and working on the irrigation system.
Yeah. So this is something that probably should have happened a year ago, 2 years ago, or something.
Well, Jesus, if you've been reading Cable for 24 issues, you would probably argue it should have happened about 22 issues ago. But because that saga has been of a type.
Okay. So what is this? This is the beginning of the Second Coming storyline. It's a big deal for the X-Men. This is Cable coming back with the mutant girl Hope, who is the first mutant to be born after M-Day, right?
Right, right.
And so he took her into the future, and come with me if you want to live, kind of thing. And everybody was after her.
She's been doing an excellent job. Yeah, basically, Bishop blames Hope for the dystopian Sentinel future that he grew up in, and so he thought if he just strangled a baby in the crib, then he could live with himself in that he would never exist in the first place in this form, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, he spent 2 years doing this sort of Clint Eastwood time travel movie with you know, Cable one step ahead of him, jumping backward and forward, mostly forward in time.
It was a pretty cool idea.
Yeah, it and Dwayne's. I don't mean to dismiss it by saying it should have resolved 22 issues ago, but every month that Dwayne Szczesny kept going with it, my jaw fell a little further. Like how much longer could they possibly do this? Yeah. And then just like that, I mean, and that wrapped up, I thought, in a very satisfying fashion. And then here we were in Finchtown, and suddenly it was like old home week for all the racists who've hated the X-Men since I was
yeah, everybody's getting together.
Yeah, it was like, oh my gosh, it's those smiley face robot things from X Factor when I was 11. Wow, long time no see. And I don't know. I don't know at this point why the people who hate the X Men don't just all get together, because these Yost and is it Kyle and Yost?
Yeah,
Craig and Yost. I can't. It's, one of them has two first names and it ruins everything. But they in their X Force book they. It's just like a rotating wheel of racists who Wolverine and company have to massacre. And every time I see them, I think, why don't these people all just convene? They could share their resources. They could set up an org chart. This would be a lot more efficient for them. But yeah, the hockey mask guys are there, and the smiley face robots are there, and you know
the guy with a cross, and
yeah,
there's a big guy on a crucifix thing.
If I say things to you like Master Mold or Nimrod, do they have any meaning to you whatsoever?
Well, back to,
they
back
make
to
me
the,
giggle.
The Saturday morning yes, cartoon, right. I remember that stuff, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That, see.
He's like a big sentinel?
Yeah.
It's a big crucified sentinel? Okay.
Well, yeah. And the guy with the unfortunate, very 90s-sounding name of Bastion is a combination of the Master Mold and Nimrod. And he's apparently the bad guy that I'm supposed to care about.
He's giving all the orders too. And if you have all these different guys working for you, I'd be like, can you help me off the cross, please? Right.
Yeah. Why is
put
he
in a chair?
Why, I don't know this guy. Why is he on
like
the cross?
A rickshaw.
Maybe you can put it back at a nice 45-degree angle.
I always think about these dramatic scenes that take place on the one page where they all look up and the guy's dangling from the ceiling on a cross. And then I think about, what does that guy do with the other 23 hours and 45 minutes of his day?
I have an itch. Like,
right. They all go, okay, so we're going to make a Starbucks run. Do you need anything?
And I feel like at some point there was some kind of get-together for all the X-Men writers. They had one of their retreats, and they pulled out a Gideon Bible and started pulling biblical references, because all the X-Men books are, you know, Second Coming, Messiah Complex, all that stuff, Guy on a Crucifix. I think the mutants are a little melodramatic. I think
at least a couple of the League of Racists are fundamentalist militiamen, who, you know, William Stryker, X-Men movies notwithstanding, was a preacher when I was a little kid.
Right, right.
So I do. Speaking of preaching, I did like when Wolverine or whatever, like X-23. Stabs a guy through the head. She stabs one of the hockey mask racists through the head, and Nightcrawler lectures her about how they don't kill people roughly two pages after he teleported through the windshield of a car that was driving 80 miles an hour down the highway.
Yeah,
totally. I don't know if he hadn't examined Cyclops' plan as carefully as he thought when he was getting on his moral high horse, but yeah.
I really love that two-page spread, by the way. I thought that was really badass. I thought this book was really exciting. There were some really exciting moments to it, and it sort of made me really enjoy the sort of team effort to fight to get this task done in a way that I just hadn't seen in an X-Men book for a while. I could be wrong. It might be happening all the time in the other titles.
Well, it will be for the next 6 months. I will say the one thing about this book that broke my heart was turning to the last page and seeing a checklist.
Oh, yeah.
I was sure that it was a miniseries, and then it was like, to be continued in 9 books. God damn it. But, you know, what are you going to do, I guess? I would like to hear Cyclops' plan for exactly how Hope saves the world.
Yeah.
He's just sure he knows.
A very large womb.
Yeah. because I've been thinking through this plan, and that kid's still underage. So I don't know what Cyclops thinks is going to happen there, but he might need to take it to Thailand or something at the very least. But maybe I'm overthinking it.
Well, maybe I don't know if they ship to Thailand, but if you were traveling and not around a local comic book store, you might want to go to In Stock Trades.
Did that really just happen?
I think You know, I was looking at ways to do it, and it's better than the womb.
I'm just gonna respect your choices, and I'm gonna
If you're in the womb and you
need
some
comics. Womb and you need some comics, these guys apparently they will deliver lots of places. This is a great place to buy trade paperbacks and all, you know, which is a great way. By the way, I can't wait to read the Blackest Night trade, and I will get it from In Stock Trades. Because over there I'll save up to 37% and free shipping on orders over $50. And you know, these trades add up, so this is good, especially, you know, for Easter. And they have over 9,000 trade paperbacks in stock and available for order right now. New releases listed every Wednesday, just like their floppy counterparts. And the orders usually ship within 48 hours. It's pretty good. And it's all at www.instocktrades.com. And you know what? I'm adding this thing about Summit City Con. It's all about they are actually hosting the Summit City Comic Con on May 22nd in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Are you guys going to go to that? Are you?
Now that I know about
it. I want to go to that. It would be fun to go to Fort Wayne. But that's if you want to see the weather there or learn about the Summit City Comic Con, www.summitcitycomiccon.com. And there's a bunch of C's in there, and they're right next to each other. But we thank In Stock Trades for sponsoring this beautiful mess that we're in. So speaking of beautiful messes, Fantastic Four, number 577. Why is this on the list? They go to the moon. I heard some stuff happen.
They go to the moon. They meet the Lost Inhumans. They get a really excellent graduate level lecture on the nature of inhuman development and Kree genetics. And
this educational. Yeah,
I've never seen a PowerPoint presentation inside a comic book before, but this was as good a time as any. No, I mean, the Dale Eaglesham art was consistently excellent. It's obvious Jonathan Hickman has a lot of great ideas. He perhaps has so many that he needs to occasionally bring a character out to stand at a podium and explain them for 15 pages or
Listen,
so.
Listen, guys, at the end of 580, there's going to be a quiz in the back of the book, and you have to send it in, and you're going to get something awesome.
I like the vaguely,
your ability to continue reading will be graded.
Right. I like the iPad app at the back of each issue that sort of shows you all the stuff that they could draw.
This one was the least troubling of those so far.
It's the Dragnet thing. It tells you what happens. Right. Or it's the end of Cool Runnings, where they tell you that they came back for another Olympics later on.
Right. I could deal with a text scroll from the last 3 minutes of Animal House level of iPad-itude, but that's kind of like you turn to the last page of an issue of Fantastic Four and they're like, here's another issue worth of stuff that, you know,
should all end with a baseball game and they each disappear and they tell you how the thing died in Vietnam and stuff like that.
So, that's right.
Why are we talking about this? Hickman has such amazing ideas, and I have to imagine that this is building up to something amazing. He started off with an amazing arc. Well, it wasn't the beginning of his run on Fantastic Four, but I mean, he did minis before that for Dark Reign, but that Reed Richards story was just incredible. And as someone who doesn't normally read Fantastic Four, it was a big draw for me to come in and start reading it regularly. Yeah. But, We need to get going, and we need some showing and not telling pretty soon.
Fantastic Four has always been, even especially during the Mark Waid era, when I started reading it for the first time after years of not being particularly interested in it as a child. It's a lot more about imagination and exploration than it is about fisticuffs and, you know, detective work and crime busting. And so on and so forth. Like, and I'm not a comic book fan who reads it and complains that there wasn't enough action and, you know, like, no one punched anyone. Me not like. Like, you run into that's an entire subgenre sub.
Yeah, I love all the science in this. I love all the exploration, and I'm fine with it not being, you know, a slobber knocker of a book. But he needs to tone it down just a little bit with the verbiage in there.
It's like, I get it. You've got lots of ideas. You're really smart, but let's tell a story too. And it's funny. It's almost, I mean, I really like the Inhumans. I don't know a lot about them. I've completely missed out on that whole thing that they're doing off in space. But so it's kind of fun to get a touch of that again.
Yeah, that's, That cosmic Abnett and Lanning stuff. You know, if you're looking for a reason to have some in stock trades delivered to your womb, those are the ones to start with. but
it's nice every once in a while to get a postcard from the Inhumans back here on Earth or close by on the moon, our satellite.
Occasionally with that Atlantis issue of Fantastic Four last month and the Inhumans one this month, it goes into this level of history and you know, sort of phylum and of these various different you know, races, and I sort of think, are you illustrating a TSR monster manual, or are these characters eventually going to do something?
I seriously had that same note. It's just like it's like getting set for Dungeons and Dragons. And when I was a kid, I was invited to one of those sessions, and I spent the whole time like plotting who my character was and coming up with a backstory. And we never got to the actual fighting in it.
I think that's what's happening here. We're rolling for abilities right now, and I think the time has come for somebody to step up. I can't continue that metaphor any further.
Well, let's just hope that somebody rolls a one on their die 12 and there's a random encounter.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Presumably. Okay, guys. So I've got a thing about Incorruptible, number 4. And I just got to get off my chest immediately. Maybe I'm just getting too used to the detail that I see in Blackest Night and other books, but I just don't like the art in this book at all. It's just so static. I pay too much attention. For me, the art is a big part of the comic because I like to. It makes it more. It's just more exciting for me when the art is really, really
There's
good.
Nothing wrong with that.
But I feel like the story could be great. But I just.
On the iFanboy website this past week, there was a discussion about, I want to say Patrick Zurcher went online and said that he was drawing a line in the sand and he wanted artists to get equal billing on book covers with the writers. Mm-hmm. And he had, you know, the example that they use is the Gotham Central hardcovers where Rucka and Brubaker's names are gigantic and, you know, Michael Lark is a tiny little footnote down in the bottom left-hand corner. And the discussion that broke out in that on that page in the site was, you know, whether will you buy a book that is well written but not necessarily well drawn? What about if it's beautiful but Jeff Loeb or someone, you know, that you don't necessarily care for is the writer and you know, so on and so forth. And it sounds like, Mike, this is something of a deal breaker for you.
Sometimes. I mean, it's distracting. I just feel like there's so many artists out there that are working their tails off to produce really good stuff. And when I see lack of detail and just sort of like boring backgrounds or no backgrounds at all, it just frustrates me because I know there are so many artists out there that are want to do this and sort of deliver better goods, frankly. And I feel like this book is really compelling and I think it could be really interesting, but I felt like there was a little bit of a misstep in this. And even story-wise too, frankly.
It took me a while to warm up to Irredeemable and I've been assuming that it's just sort of taking me a little while to warm up to its counterpart as well. Maybe not.
I feel like this could have just been a mini series and have Irredeemable being ongoing. I don't know if there's really room for this book, but I'm willing to trust Mark Waid on this. But I have been more impressed with the hope that this book is going to be good as opposed to the actual pages that I'm turning. The covers are nice, though. The covers are gorgeous, actually.
I like the ideas. I'm still waiting to see how they're going to pay off. I would say that this, the end of the last issue and the beginning of this one had the most emotional payoff and gave me the most to think about so far.
Yeah.
Giant robots, not... I don't care so much.
That was I literally heaved a sigh of disappointment when the giant robot came out.
You know, like, you know,
really... he's on the cover.
Yeah, right. Well he's on one of
the covers. It was a metaphorical giant robot.
I have cover B and I have him with the girl in the background. And I was like, oh, this is going to be awesome. It's like a murder mystery. She's in the background. She's kind of hot. And then there's this big robot.
You know, Mike, when we started talking about doing this show a couple of weeks ago, I remember Paul saying, "Ooh, yeah, that's a good week for books." And as I was reading this,
things
week,
got
I
moved.
Confess, yeah, I was gonna. As I was looking this week, I was like, "Really? Maybe? Yeah.
Flash book got moved. That's what I was excited about."
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, because I'm listening to Mike, and he's like, "God damn these co-features and these backup stories."
I know.
I had fun reading my comics this week.
Stupid artwork.
Yeah, stupid artists with their pens and their pencils.
Okay.
You should have read the Mr. T one-shot, fool.
I'm telling you. I'm telling you, right.
It's also a time to celebrate because it's what, the 30th anniversary of the She-Hulk?
The sensational
She-Hulk.
Oh, my
gosh, it is. That's a character that cannot catch a break.
I love how they talk about that through the book, too. Like, she's like, when are people going to start reading me? Even I had no idea. Even when they have I actually kind of enjoyed the John Byrne second story that they had in there, the reprint. And I didn't know that they were complaining about their ratings even back then. No one was reading it.
Yeah, John Byrne is, in a lot of ways, the things about Deadpool that are draining my life force out of my body can be blamed on John Byrne's She-Hulk run. I read that at the time, and if you go back to when Stan Lee invented or co-created or whatever he did with She-Hulk in 30 years ago.
You have done this. This is up on your wall. You have charts tracing it back.
They played that concept straight as a heart attack in 1980. There was no irony. There was no winking. There was no fun-loving, you know, green gal about town. She was her cousin's cousin. So she started out as like a scantily clad, ripped through the prim dress, throwing cars at people sort of She-Hulk, and then over the years they developed the character a lot more to where like they started doing somebody somewhere along the line started to explore the idea of the id and the suppressed self, and whereas Bruce Banner always repressed his anger, so when he turned into the Hulk he was a monstrosity, Jennifer Walters always sort of suppressed her wild side and her fun-loving side because she was this prim, uptight lawyer. And so when she became She-Hulk, she became uninhibited and kind of more pleasant company. And then I guess when John Byrne started writing her second series when I was a kid, he took that and ran with it. And she started doing a lot of breaking the fourth wall that seemed a lot more fun and interesting and revolutionary before I realized that they were going to do it on every single page of Deadpool until I begged for mercy.
I found that very distracting, I got to say. I mean, I think it's cute once in a while, but like...
My friend. Yes, there you have it. That having been said, I did not suggest we talk about She-Hulk so that I could critique its entire...
It's just a way so you could talk about Deadpool.
Style. Right, no.
It's a Trojan horse.
I always lamented Dan Slott was writing She-Hulk back when neither one of them could get any respect, and that was a great series that I wish more people had kind of given a chance to. And
it's the lawyer stuff, yeah.
It was the lawyer stuff, and it's sort of like he came up with the best way to explain inconsistent characterization in continuity that I've ever heard, where basically people from alternate realities were taking a vacation in this one. So if you ever saw She-Hulk sleeping with the Juggernaut for no reason that made any sense, it was because that wasn't really her. That was her alternate dimension doppelganger vacationing here for the weekend or whatever. And he had a really clever approach to stuff like that. Like, I think that was, there was an issue there where Spider-Man sued Jameson for libel, and, you know, it explored a lot of fun stuff in kind of a winking way without having She-Hulk turn and look at the reader Animal Man style and, you know, crack it. Joke or whatever, but this comic, basically Peter David gets his hands back on She-Hulk again, and they sort of do a Christmas Carol riff where they look at the savage She-Hulk of the 80s and the, you know, the lawyer She-Hulk of more recent times, and they, you know, sort of jokingly look at what is coming for her in the future, and then they, you know, there's a John Byrne reprint that Mike liked quite a lot, and
quite a lot. I mean,
he loved it. He loved it. It was all he could talk about.
I love John Byrne. I can't believe how great he is. And then there was a second one with a little team up with Captain Marvel and Jessica Drew.
The Brian Reed one. Yes, there was a weird consistency in that I'm probably a loser for even caring about. But the Ms. Marvel in that story goes out of her way to say like two or three times, I don't know Spider-Woman that well.
Yeah, what was that about?
That contradicts everything that I know about Ms. Marvel and Spider-Woman, but I guess it's not that big a deal. If you like She-Hulk, you'll like this. If you like Peter David's take on She-Hulk in particular, you'll like this. There's a extended cameo by Stan Lee. So that, you know what? That basically tells you everything you need to know about the book. If the idea of She-Hulk being visited by Stan Lee as the ghost of Christmas past or whatever is interesting to you, then amen. Go with God.
It's an entertaining romp.
Yes. You don't need to read it to know what is happening in War of the Hulks or Fall of the...
Oh, God.
You know.
I'm not going anywhere near that stuff. Just so you know.
All right. So user reviews.
This is a thing I'm supposed to do. The first thing that
embarrassing.
It's been since August. If they would, you know, they keep farming it out to caterers. How's that supposed to make me
read
feel?
Read the thing.
All right. Dragon Age number one was reviewed by Silver Age Tom, who gave the story a 5 and the art a 5. I think he probably liked it. Let's find out. He says, "Now, I'm usually one to pass on any video game tie-in comic because they usually aren't any good. However, one thing stuck out at me when I saw this book on the shelves. It was co-written by Orson Scott Card, that factoid, in Congress with the fun art and vibrant coloring." He said in Congress. Made me pick this book up off the shelf.
Don't be a dick. Just read the
thing. I'm not being a dick. I'm admiring his turn of phrase. The book, written at least in part by sci-fi legend Orson Scott Card and Aaron Johnston, the story takes place in the Circle Tower.
Kinky.
A place where people with magical aptitude are taken to learn under the careful supervision of warriors called the Templars. Without going too deeply into the politics of the world, mages aren't well trusted, because once upon a time they almost brought about the end of the world. The characters are fun and well-rounded, and the story makes a good show of elevating itself above the run-of-the-mill sword and sorcery fare. In short, it's a strong start, and it makes me want to read more. I cannot argue with that.
That's the danger with these things. They're addictive, these morpegs.
Yes, and also these licensed tie-ins, which are apparently defying all our expectations these days.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear it's good. I'm glad he enjoyed it. That's good. The next user review is Gotham City Sirens number 10, and the review is by I Make Reality. That is very deep. The story was 4, very good, and art 4, very good. I Make Reality wonders, am I really just totally nuts for enjoying this book? No, I don't think you are, by the way. I know I'm going to catch hell for this, but this book keeps me coming back each month, month after month, so long as it's Deanie writing one of my favorite Bat characters. And I don't even mean in the he's the best at capturing Harley's voice kind of way. I actually enjoyed this for his take on the Riddler. The pissy, bored genius of Edward Nigma has always been a lot of fun, and his current storyline has a load of potential. When Deanie takes you into Nigma's head, there's a definite sense of Edward Nigma's voice competing with the voice of the Riddler. Thankfully, it's not done in a Deadpool way, but with more of a self-examining style that is often attributed to the Batman. And I actually had dropped this book, but I keep thinking I want to pick it up. Do you guys read this?
I never gave it a chance, I must confess.
Not bad.
Yeah.
The art in the first couple issues is really badass.
It seems to me this was another one of those ones that was allegedly Paul Dini and then abruptly wasn't. Does that sound right? Yeah. And I liked Paul Dini on Detective, but he whack-a-moled me with some fill-ins one time too many. I don't take so many chances on him no more.
Okay, let's talk about some emails. Chris G. writes, "Bendis has done an incredible job over the past few years developing Luke Cage into a Marvel heavyweight and a personal favorite of mine. Do you think it's time Marvel gave Bendis a solo Luke Cage book? And if so, who should draw it? And do you guys think it would be hit or a miss? Thanks a lot. Keep up the good work." Thank you, Chris.
In a lot of ways, I sort of feel like that's happening already.
How so, Jim?
Well, I feel like Luke Cage, for being in a book that also stars Captain America and Spider-Man, gets an inordinate amount of attention and character development in Bendis' hands in the pages of the New Avengers. And that's not a complaint. It's just an observation. Like, I don't know what Bendis' Luke Cage book would be accomplishing that Luke Cage's Bendis' New Avengers book is not already accomplishing. And if I just had a Freudian slip where I mixed up Luke Cage and Brian Bendis, well, maybe there's something to be explored there too.
But he's really busy in these books. I don't know what else he would be doing. But you know, you could read. Remember, did you guys read that Richard Corbin Cage book from many, many years ago?
Not familiar with it.
It was like
I probably wasn't ready yet.
A lot of people really didn't like it, but there is a I think it has been collected into a trade, and it's called Cage, and it's drawn by Richard Corbin. I forgot who wrote it, but I have a feeling you won't like it.
That is a Corbin is a very distinctive art style.
It's really trippy looking, man.
I'm a big Corbin fan. That sounds interesting.
The art is awesome, but it's like definitely like thug life. You know, it's not witty banter Luke Cage in Avengers. It's like this guy's a hard dude. But it's I mean, I enjoyed it at the time, but I think Bendis has made Luke Cage really, really appealing and really, really fun. But honestly, I just don't know if the market would support it. I mean, I just don't know.
Yeah. I've also heard good things about Luke Cage Noir, which I believe is wrapped up. But I heard very good things about that. So that's on my list to check out. But yeah, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing it just Bendis in general going back to doing, you know, more solo series. Things like Alias, as opposed to.
Oh,
the
I was
Avengers,
looking so but... forward. I was looking so forward to that Spider-Woman book. I cannot even tell you. I don't know. Did you follow the Spider-Woman book?
I'm reading it.
It became a miniseries quite abruptly, in issue 6 or 7, because they did a motion comic of it, and the end result of the motion comic was that Maleev never wanted to. Was it Maleev? Was it? I don't want to get this wrong. It was him, right?
Yeah. Yes,
He never, as a result of the motion comic, it took a very long time to get each issue prepared, and he never wanted to see Spider-Woman again as long as he lived by the time they got to about issue 7.
Oh, really?
So it just sort of ended. Hmm. And I was really looking forward. I loved the pitch. I loved the character. Anyway, and part of it was because I do miss Bendis doing that sort of street-level single character or, you know, single main character book. And I wouldn't. I mean, if he wrote a Cage book, I would buy it. I can't think of my mind is every the name of every artist I've ever heard of in my life has run out of my head now that I've been put on the spot. But I don't know who I would have draw it. You know,
I like the Richard Corbin idea.
let's say Umberto Ramos. How's that? Blow everyone's mind at the back of their heads. But yeah, I mean, I'd buy it. I think it would be the three of us on the podcast here, and Chris,
we'd all love it. Yeah.
And then our letter writing campaign would fall on deaf ears, and we'd all cry on our sword trades.
So if you have a note for the iFanboys, write them at contact@ifanboy.com, and hopefully they won't fall on their swords at that time either.
Right.
So we do have a voicemail from Dave Withnall, where he asks where to store and sell all those comics.
G'day guys, Dave from Brisbane, Australia here. With the amount of comics you read each week, you each must have collections well into the thousands, and I can imagine the space that takes up is phenomenal. Just wondering what you do to keep your collections from getting out of hand. Do you ever sell your old runs? If so, do you have any tips on where to start? I'm loving all the new content on the site, and keep up your great work.
Oh, Dave. You know, my first article for iFanboy was the journey of my stack.
I remember that.
It crawled from my I'm in my bedroom now doing this. From my nightstand to the drawer under my nightstand to this shelf right there and then into my closet. And I have actually stayed up, eyes wide open, sweating about where I'm going to keep my comics. Like I've gotten rid of boxes and you're right. We get a lot of comics and they just keep growing and I'm running out of room and I'm wondering, guys, do you have a good system? Because what happens to me is I end up going, well, I can't fit another long box under my clothes, so now I'm gonna have to get rid of them.
Here's what I do. There's an abandoned lot a few blocks down. I take them down there and I dig for a long time, and I put them down there, and that's every 6 months or so I throw them down there, unless there's a really bad issue, and then I'll just go, I'll deliver that personally to the landfill. There's a lot of cats down there. It's a little weird. Somebody asked me what I was doing. So, it's just bodies.
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah, you feel less ashamed of that.
No, to be honest, my actual answer is I have drawer boxes, and I have short boxes. I have stacks of them on either side of a bookcase, and I don't know. I'm going to need to move them out soon. I'm actually considering putting them up at a yard sale I'm having this weekend. So I'll see if anything sells. I don't know.
You have got to be ruthless. I understand the impulse to save them. For years we thought they were going to be worth money. For years we thought we were going to read them over and over again, because when we were 10, that's what we did. We could afford three, and we read them until they fell apart. But I've in recent years, I've been just cruel and heartless about looking through my long boxes and saying, never going to read this again. Got this on DVD-ROM. Got, you know, and just, I went through a long period where I would just recycle them outright when I was done reading them. And for before that, I felt, when I still had that collector's impulse and I felt guilty about recycling them and I thought somebody else was going to want to read them, there were times when I would just abandon them in nearby school playgrounds and stuff. Like some sort of creepy weirdo. But as it happens, last week I wrote an article about this for iFanboy 2 a couple of months ago. I at some point boxed up a bunch of comics that I thought were going to be really valuable or really loved by people, like the entire run of Astonishing X-Men and like All-Star Superman and stuff, thinking I would eBay them or sell them or something. And that box was in the trunk of my car for literally over 2 years until last week. The box, I turned one too many sharp corners and the box just ripped open and I had this blanket of comics in my trunk. And I finally broke down and went into my local shop and asked them if they'd buy them. And they gave me like 10 cents a issue store credit on them. And every book they didn't take, I walked over to Goodwill. And that was that. Like, you know, I understand why we hold on to them the way we do. But, yeah. You know, if your grandmother was doing this with TV Guide, you'd put her in a home.
Yeah.
Well, guys, we've slaughtered another episode of the iFanboy Pick of the Week. Now, Jim, it had been August for you. I have a feeling it's going to be even longer for me after this.
Yeah, right. you've burned your last ounce of goodwill. Yeah.
I'm going to have to buy the guys drinks at WonderCon, and I'm disappointed that I'm not seeing you guys there, by the way.
WonderCon?
Yeah, I'm going up to WonderCon.
Tell me more. Yeah, Ron and Connor are there right now, correct?
Yeah.
San Francisco, and you're headed out there as this is going out to people.
Yeah, exactly right. I'm actually coming back from there if you're listening to this on Sunday. But so that's the show, guys. Good job. And by the way, I must say, week after week, I'm always amazed at what you guys are writing. First of all, I cannot believe that we are each able to come up with somewhat original ideas every week. I don't think anybody who is at the site knows how hard that is.
Not so fast, Mike. I'm not ready to call any of it on my part all that original. But in case anyone is still listening and wonders why we've been allowed to do this instead of Josh, Ron, and Hunter for the past hour, it's because we are the first of the staff writers at iFanboy.com. We write articles that are on the site every week, as do Josh and Ron and Hunter. And we encourage you to all go and check them out. Check ours out. Check theirs out. There's been a lot of new content lately.
There is a website.
Yes, yeah. It's true.
So just nebulous audio coming out of nowhere. There is a website and lots of good content from everybody. More and more stuff lately. And there's only going to be more and more and more and more and more. So hope you enjoy that. We're filling up your Google Reader or whatever.
And if you liked, if you like this stuff, go check out iFanboy.com for the Pick of the Week review if you want to learn more about what Josh had to say about the final issue of Blackest Night. And, of course, there's a lot more in-depth comic book discussion. I mean, this is just the very tip of the iceberg. And there's lots of important news and all sorts of topics that we talk about every day. They say throw up on the website. I like to say that we post because what we write is not throw up.
Yes.
Wow. So go to – and if you are at all interested in who the heck we are, look at ifanboy.com/about to see our social networking links. And the guys do a video show, which is actually quite good because we're not on it. The last week they did – what was it?
That was the voicemail show.
Oh, that's cool.
Answering all your questions.
Yeah. And then next week – incredibly, they're doing the WonderCon show, which
is all things.
That is pretty amazing. It's just a couple.
And when
days
you
late.
Say when you say they, don't you mean we?
I do mean we.
You're gonna be doing some of that stuff.
Yeah, you're right. I got.
You got a lot of good stuff lined up for us.
Oh, of course I do.
Any teases?
Yeah. he signed a non-disclosure agreement. This is exactly the way Josh got fired.
There'll be awkward photos of me with like. That I've always liked, but we're trying. Actually, the guys are doing lots of interviews, and it should be pretty good. We've got a really great party with Amanda Connor, Jimmy Palmiotti, and Darwin Cook, and then we're going out in the town with Dave Johnson on Friday night. So there will be ample time for discussions with.
You're going to get good and sloshed, are you?
Well, I feel bad because I didn't find out about Amanda Connor until late after I wrote my Artist of the Year, and I feel really bad because I thought she was a fantastic artist last year, and so I will apologize. But I will try to restrain myself because the Tiki Tour is also known as the worst headache ever on Saturday, so I got to be careful. Because those tiki drinks are sugary. They're not good for your liver. Anyway, let's close this up. Paul.
Okay, well, if you have any incriminating photos of Mike in an alleyway passed out, you can email us at contact@ifanboy.com or you can leave a voicemail at 1-888-FANBOYS. That's 326-2697. With any questions, comments, concerns, discussion topics, photos. I'm sending a bounty. I'll give you right. 10 Amazon dollars if you incriminating photo of Mike. Actually, I shouldn't lower that because that's probably going to happen.
Anything blackmailable. Easy. It all depends on how incriminating you think him dancing in the middle of the con floor is.
I was really sick when I did that, by the way. I hope people appreciate that. Almost fainted.
Delirium is a double-edged sword.
And if you dig us, write us a review in iTunes, or better yet, tell your friends about us. Introduce your mom to podcasts. Spread the iFanboy word. We're very, very approachable in that way. It's a good podcast for mom to listen to.
Yeah. Good luck explaining.
Have you had your mom listen to it?
My God. good news, Mom. An opportunity to listen to me talk for an hour. What? Come back. No, that's not going to happen.
Well, that's it for this week's show. I'm Paul.
And I'm Mike.
And I'm Jim.